Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa this week requested the city council vote on an ordinance banning tents from all public parks. The ordinance is based on an existing law that disallows camping in parks but is widely seen as an attempt to prevent a new Occupy LA encampment on the city lawn. Groups advocating for the city's homeless are outraged, saying it is part of the mayor's, quote, continuing criminalization of the poor and protesters. Such laws and ordinances, policies and practices that shape the political geography of Los Angeles are often lost to history. While tourists and even many Angelenos conjure the Hollywood Boulevard or Olvera Street as best representing the city's significance, there are countless street corners, buildings, parks, and other spaces whose cultural and political history is part of LA's fabric, but are in danger of being obscured by the glamour and glitz that conventional guidebooks direct tourists towards. Now, a new book called A People's Guide to Los Angeles, written by Laura Pulido, Laura Balaklov, and Wendy Cheng, attempts to document those obscure and intimate histories. The authors, quote, show how everyday people are exploited and disenfranchised by capital and the state, how those same people sometimes mobilize to create alternative forms of power, how racism, sexism, class differences, and homophobia lead to conflict and struggle, how dominant ideas are memorialized in landscapes, and how Los Angeles has been a constant site of struggle between nature and people. Laura Pulido and Wendy Cheng, two of the co-authors, now join me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Pulido, you are a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, currently a visiting professor in Black Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. And Wendy Cheng, you're an assistant professor of Asian Pacific American Studies and Justice and Social Inquiry at Arizona State University. I should mention, Laura, you've also written a book, Black, Brown, Yellow, and Left, Radical Activism in Los Angeles. So you're certainly not, you're a veteran, if you will, of studying Los Angeles. First, explain why you decided to write this kind of a book chock full of the history and cultural aspects of Los Angeles in the form of a guidebook.
Well, that was not our original intention. when we first decided, I had been researching actually the previous book that you mentioned, and I had encountered many interesting places, and I was collecting them. And then a friend of mine, Tony Osumi, said, well, why don't you put them together and call it A People's Guide to L.A.? And I really liked that idea, and I started working on it. But for many years, I was searching for the right kind of format. And initially, I was very drawn to the idea of like a coffee table book. And I imagined, you know, lots of white space, beautiful photographs, kind of documenting these oppositional sites. But when we talked to editors and presses about it, they said, no, no, make it a tour guide. And the thinking there is that if you really want to get people to go to those places, you have to kind of put it on a map and make it very clear to people how to do that. And so we struggled with that for a while, but eventually we saw they really were right, and that was the right path to go. But it did require a lot of rethinking and work on our part because we had never done a guidebook.
The guidebook not only has the actual spaces and, of course, the photographs, the parks and the buildings, but you have personal reflections by people who have lived the history of Los Angeles. How did you go about gathering those personal reflections, and why is that important, Wendy?
Well, I think the personal reflections also speak to our process of bringing the book together, which involves so many more people than just the three of us. And so the way we built the knowledge in the book was by tapping networks, people that we knew, people we might have organized campaigns with, people that were personal friends who really led us to many of these sites. So the personal reflections are just a slice of how the book actually came to be, you know, in these sort of everyday knowledges that people have about the spaces that they occupy, and trying to bring those to the forefront as important to the history of the city.
But you also throw in your favorite restaurants. And how did you divide up the city? Start out talking about North Los Angeles, which is not actually a recognized part of the city. We talk about South LA, we talk about downtown, the West Side, but we don't really say North LA.
No, it's a geographic region we created. And the idea there, when you actually put all these sites on a map, there's a very clear clustering around what might be called downtown, midtown Los Angeles, mid-city area. places we all know. But we had to create, I think we create 7 zones for LA County. So we have the San Fernando Valley, West Side, and so on. But if you think about this area that is like downtown, mid-city area, north of that, there's no unifying term. And so we want to kind of juxtapose that with South LA or South Central LA, as it used to formally be called, because that's become such a racialized site. You know, you say that word and a certain set of images, territory, people come to mind in very
racialized
tourists.
And tourist buses don't stop there.
Absolutely not. So we just wanted to, you know, race is such a spatialized kind of process. And so we kind of wanted to play on that and bring that out for people to begin thinking about, well, if there is this thing called, you know, North LA that we're making up, well, where does that come from? And what kind of work does that do, especially in relationship to other places like East LA, South LA?
Let's talk about some of the places that you focus on in your book. We were just talking earlier with a woman who's an activist working on ending foreclosures in Southern California. Well, losing homes is not a new crisis in Southern California. And you have a section in your book as part of the North Los Angeles section on Chavez Ravine, which to longtime Angelenos is a familiar word, but maybe for new implants, something that they don't really know about. And they know Dodger Stadium, but they don't know that history of people being kicked out of their homes. And you have these dramatic photos of women and children and families being pulled out of their homes. Tell us a little bit about that history and how you sort of express it in this guidebook. Go ahead, Laura.
You know, you're right. The Chavez Ravine is kind of like this legendary thing. And so we debated, actually, well, should we include it because it's so well known? But on the other hand, that's an important part of a city, is its memories, its history, and its legends. So we thought it was really important to include it. And what happened at Chavez Ravine, it refers to a series of communities just north of downtown. They were primarily Mexicano rural communities. And they were declared to be blighted in the 1940s. And this was a time when Los Angeles was having a real serious housing crisis. And so the idea was they were going to be blighted, dozed, and then public housing was going to be built in those sites. Well, that public housing was never built because at the time, this is the moment of the Red Scare. And there was people called this an example of creeping socialism, a lot of landlord organizations got together to fight it, this kind of public ownership. So as a result, the people were kicked out, they were dozed out, the entire communities were dozed down, and there was no public housing built. But you have this land then that's all kind of been prepped, if you will, for development. And along come then the Dodgers from Brooklyn wanting to relocate. And so pretty much they picked up this land for a song, as much of the work had been done at public expense. So a lot of times people think that the Dodgers kicked out the people. That's not what happened. It was done by the city to create public housing, but that never happened.
Another aspect to your book is you draw attention to those spaces of exclusion historically that it excluded folks, whether they were poor folks or people of color. In certain parts of LA, the California Club is one that you talk about. Interestingly enough, San Marino's Lacey Park is another one, which, you know, it's living in Pasadena, I've been told by many of, many moms that I know that it's a fantastic place to go, but you have to pay to go on the weekends. It's a public park. Tell us about some of these spaces.
Okay. Well, Lacey Park is a great example. I think also about how we try to make connections between privileged spaces and poor spaces, mm-hmm. and about how you can't really understand one of those without understanding the other side of it. So Lacey Park is a great example of what seems like an innocuous space, right? This beautiful park that was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted in one of the wealthiest communities in the United States. But what you see is all of these larger processes coming together, right? The defunding of parks in poorer areas and the concentration of resources in wealthier neighborhoods, and also the ability of those neighborhoods to control their space and who has access to that space by mandating fees for non-residents on the weekends, and also a permit system if you want to bring in a group larger than 15, which of course targets many poor people coming from surrounding areas who want to enjoy that space too. Mm-hmm. So I think in our book, we also have examples, you know, we have a lot of examples. examples of how these processes are linked, right? So we don't have Florence and Normandy, for example, but we do have the site where Rodney King was pulled over and beaten up in the San Fernando Valley in Sylmar, right? And we have the...
And that's a forgotten space.
Right, yes. But it's so important that he was there in this space that's been created out of exclusion and white privilege, and that's where that happened, right? So we think that those spaces are equally important to understanding rather than focusing on these areas of the city that are more typically considered sites of social unrest.
Mm. My guests are Wendy Chen and Laura Pulido. They are the co-authors of the new book, A People's Guide to Los Angeles, and they're going to be speaking about their book at a number of local events. They are going to be at Autry in Griffith Park on Saturday, May 12th. That is 4700 Western Heritage Way. Romans on the 7th of June at 7 p.m., and then they're going to be at Skylight Books on the 11th of May at 7:30 p.m. And we'll put all of that information on our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Let's go to East L.A. Again, our listeners who are in East L.A., these spaces may be nothing new to them, but those maybe on the West Side or in our Santa Barbara and San Diego listening areas may not know about Chuco's Justice Center and Free L.A. High School. They may not know about the sites of, and of course in South L.A., actually Chuco's Justice Center is in South L.A., they may not know about many of these spaces. Tell us what you think our listeners should know about East L.A. first, and then we'll move on to South L.A.
Oh, wow. There's so much to
There's so much to know, yes.
Where does one begin?
Well, the Chicano moratorium happened in East L.A.
Absolutely. With the Chicano moratorium is known as the largest anti-war protest on the part of any community of color during the Vietnam War. And this was a very significant march. It was a march that activists organized. And I forget where they started, but they ended up over at Ruben Salazar Park.
It is now called
Ruben Salazar Park. And when they got to the park, that's when they were attacked by police. And it was a huge, an extreme example of police violence and unrest, where people were hospitalized and hurt. And for many Chicanos in particular, this was like their first experience of intense political protests and police backlash on that. Of course, individuals had been used to, police brutality, but not so much in this collective kind of sense in political protest. And so the name was then, so that first happened is all these people are attacked, brutally attacked. And then later on that day, the Mexican-American journalist, Ruben Salazar, he was covering the event, and then he went over to a bar to have a drink, I guess, after a long, hot day. It's August 31st, 1970. He went to the Silver Dollar Cafe, and he gets shot then by a L.A. County sheriff. A projectile goes in and hits him in the head. Very recently, there was never any prosecution. Those records have been reviewed once again by Sheriff Baca. They decided, of course, that it was, there was no fault on the part of the sheriff. There's no need for prosecution. So it was a couple of really important events which really mark these couple of sites. We put the sites actually together, I think, in the guide, the park, as well as the cafe where he was murdered at. And they're really important parts in terms of Chicano history as well as Los Angeles history also.
And then in South Los Angeles, one thing that stood out to me was the site of the former South Central Farm. And listeners to KPFK know very well this history, but anybody walking by the area where the South Central Farm stood who didn't know that history may not have known that it was the site of the largest urban garden, urban farm in the country, I believe, run primarily by immigrant workers. How do you document this history?
Well, I think that brings up a really important question in the guide and visually, how we experience our everyday landscape. So if you go to the former site of the South Central Farm, you just see this vacant lot overgrown with weeds and a fence, right? So I think part of it is understanding how that space was the site of not just the South Central Forum, but also a successful struggle to defeat the placing of a toxic incinerator at that site, and then also a really key location in segregating South LA, right? Mm-hmm. With the Alameda Boulevard as this demarcation line between a white space and a black space. You know, so we try to make those histories come alive by putting that photograph of the vacant lot next to a photograph of a South Central farmer and to try to make people engage with that vacant lot in a way that they wouldn't necessarily without knowing, having that information all together in one place.
Mm. And so many of these histories have gotten erased by pressures of development, which is something that Los Angeles has a long, long struggle with. That continues to today. Tourists will stop by the LA Live complex in downtown LA, but they won't stop by the site of the former South Central Farm. How did you express those struggles over land that are so intimately connected with race and class and immigrant status in your guidebook, People's Guide to Los Angeles?
I guess we do it in a couple of ways. One, in the beginning of each chapter, we have kind of like a brief narrative that kind of introduces that part of Los Angeles. And so in several of those, we do try to talk about the importance of development and the tensions and struggles that arise from it. And really, when you think about really creating a guidebook of historic places as well as contemporary places in Los Angeles, you really have to deal very explicitly with development, because on the one hand, Los Angeles has this history of just continually dozing over its history, right? People say there's no history here, right? And they compare us like to other cities on the East Coast or something like that. And so there's a lot of truth to that. I don't want to pretend like there's not. On the other hand, that's not entirely true. There are a lot of our history is still there. It's evident. You oftentimes have to look with very different eyes to see it. And there also are lots of efforts, local, organic, indigenous efforts in Los Angeles to preserve that history. I mean, there's a whole cottage industry happening right now of efforts to preserve Los Angeles history, which is very, very exciting. So we see ourselves really kind of standing on the shoulders and kind of codifying what activists are doing right now in terms of providing local tours and things like that for J-Town, Little Tokyo, for example, or something like that.
Mm. And you also have sections in your book on the harbor and South Bay, where you look at the Port of LA and Liberty Hill. There's a history there with Upton Sinclair. There's, of course, the West Side, San Fernando Valley, North LA County. Listeners can get copies of the book. They're in bookstores now, and they can attend the events that the two of you are speaking at. Skylight Books on the 11th, Autry Museum on the 12th, Romans on the 7th of June. Finally, let me ask the two of you, how do you hope for this book to be used? I mean, do you expect tourists to pick it up, or is this meant for the activists? Because when I read it, to me, it's a great book for somebody new moving to LA who doesn't know the history, but who really wants to become not just engaged in their community, but maybe active in their community, because there's so many activist spaces that you also document.
I think that's certainly one of our hoped for audiences. But I think we also hope that locals, people already living in LA, will pick it up and learn about their city in a different way, or see things that have been important to them and their families reflected in this book. And we also hope that people will take it as a starting point to engage in these kinds of histories themselves, right? Think about, okay, what do I see around me, and what would I think is a people's guide type of site? So we really hope this way of thinking and engaging with the landscape and the world will spread, right? So, and that the book can serve as an entry point for that.
Are you taking input for a future edition?
always. We hope to develop a web presence. Mm. Particularly, one of the sad and painful things is just as the book was going to press, one of our sites closed down. So as soon as it comes out, it's dated. So we want to have a web presence so we can update it. People can send in their own ideas and submissions. People can react to some of the stuff that they see or experience when they go to some of these places as well.
Mm. Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today, Laura Pulido and Wendy Cheng, two of the three authors of A People's Guide to Los Angeles. Thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura Pulido is a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. She's currently a visiting professor in Black Studies at UCSB. Wendy Cheng is an assistant professor of Asian Pacific American Studies and Justice and Social Inquiry at Arizona State University. And they're going to be speaking at a number of events and locations. Check uprisingradio.org for those details. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Howard Zinn said from A People's History of the United States, the memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface. That's Howard Zinn. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day.